The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 233.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've never had the opportunity to speak with. So I'm really looking forward to this interview. I've listened to some of his stuff in the past, and it's absolutely fantastic. You're going to love this gentleman. His name is Michael Pinto. Michael, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks for having me on, George. I hope I live up to that billing.
So for my viewers who might not know your full backstory, can you get us up to speed?
Okay, so I got started in this business. I worked on the floor of New York Stock Exchange, and then I worked as a senior economist for a few firms before starting my own firm, Pinto Portfolio Strategies, in 2012. And the basis of the firm is to invest money, not like a stop clock. I don't just do a 60-40 portfolio. It's an active fund. It's called the inflation, deflation, and economic cycle model, which predicate is the second derivative of growth and inflation. So it's kind of unique. I invented this strategy, the genesis was all the way back in 2007 when I was on the Kudlow show twice a week being derided regularly because of my views on the change in the housing market and how would it affect the economy, and basically warning about a deflation and a recession cycle coming, which was going to be bad for everything, including gold. In fact, I sold my gold in August of 2008 before buying it back in early 2009. So we'll get all into that as the interview goes on. But I have now Pinto Portfolio Strategies and manage money. We are now applied to the SEC. We have well over $100 million in assets. And if you have about $100,000 to invest, you can come and get your portfolio managed in the IDEX strategy. So that's it.
What, you know, I listened to one of your recent interviews, and you were talking about the housing bubble, but then you juxtapose that to like the Buffett indicator, the CAPE ratio, and all these other metrics. And then you also talked about the bond market, interest rates being at 5,000-year lows, therefore prices being at 5,000-year highs. And although we had a housing bubble back then, we didn't have all these other bubbles in addition to that. So now, I guess my first question would be, how is what you're seeing today in markets from a psychological standpoint similar to what you saw with just the housing bubble in 2006, 2007? And then how might it be different?
Well, this is, I call it a triumvirate of bubbles. We've never had a bubble in real estate, equities, and fixed income concurrently. Never. And by the way, all those bubbles are pretty much at a record high. So
yeah,
home price to income ratio is back to where it was at the apex leading up to the credit crisis and the housing crisis and Great Recession in 2008. Actually, December 2007 is when it started officially. From the NBER, they officially call recessions. And of course, I love the Buffett indicator. We're now at over, the market cap of equities is now over 200% of underlying GDP growth. That has never before happened. It's not even close. If you look at where we were in 2007, right before the S&P lost half of its value, we were at 100%. Yeah. And even in March of 2000, we were at 140% of GDP. So you have a massive bubble in real estate, an unprecedented bubble in equities. And then when you look at fixed income, I mean, when in the history of mankind, going back to like the apes, have you seen negative interest rates? So right. Government gets paid to borrow money. And in some cases, the corporate bond market, corporations get paid to borrow money over in Europe. So $13 trillion now, the high watermark was $18 trillion not too long ago, and now we're down to $13 trillion. But I mean, I think we can both agree that interest rates are at the, you know, the sub-basement of history. And the problem, you know, the problem I see is that you have all of this new debt being piled on, corporate debt, sovereign debt, and that debt can only exist. It's only viable. It's only solvent in the context of having interest rates that are very, very low, practically free. Mm-hmm. So the average interest rate on debt in the United States that the Treasury had to pay on that debt was 7%. It is now just 2%. Of course, that gives us a semblance of solvency because, hey, you know, interest payments are pretty low. But they're only pretty low. Debt service costs are only low because you've taken interest rates down 500 basis points on average on that debt. So if we had to pay an average interest rate on the debt in the United States, our interest on the debt each year would be $1.9 trillion. Almost $2 trillion just on the interest of the national debt outstanding. It is mind-boggling because our deficits are already 15%, 16% of GDP and going higher. And that's in the context of ultra low interest rates.
Yeah.
So what happens when that rate is no longer there? That's a question you have to ask yourself.
Yeah. You're talking about that at a sovereign level, but it's my understanding that the corporate debt is at all-time highs as well. And the Fed has just created this moral hazard, in my opinion, because back in March 2020, they came in and bought corporate bonds. They bought junk debt through these special purpose vehicles. So if you're the corporation, what do? You just load up.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
So we see, what would happen to the corporate bond market if rates there became normalized or we actually had a market rate for junk debt and corporate bonds?
Well, one out of five companies now, George, is a zombie company. They have to float out new, you know, they have to borrow money to pay interest on existing debt. So you look at this statistic. Junk bond yields, the average, not CCC, just junk bonds. The average yield in junk bonds is 4%.
Right.
That's
now.
The average yield. I mean, you're talking about a yield on junk bonds that is 300 basis points below where treasuries normally should be, which is around 7%.
The risk-free rate.
This is just all gives you a context of how huge this bubble is in the bond market. And that's the predicate for everything, though. So, you know, how do you judge what the PE ratio on stocks should be? Well, it's the, you know, what's the risk-free interest rate, benchmark interest rate now, which is ridiculously low. How does that affect the housing market? Mortgage rates, it's all based upon the Fed's artificial manipulation of the sovereign bond market and the corporate bond market down to record lows. And here's my thought process here, George. The Fed purports to have this omniscience about where interest rates should be. This idea that they understand what the cost of money should be. And then they take it a step further and say that they understand how to control that rate perfectly. So they say, well, you know, we want an inflation rate that is 2% and maybe even higher than 2% for the duration that it was below 2%. When in God's good earth has a central bank been able to control interest rates? First of all, the central bank of the United States from 2008 till today had a very difficult time engendering a 2% inflation rate the way they measure it on the core PCE price index. Okay. So then they come out and they tell you, well, once we hit that rate, we could just stop whatever the heck we're doing and have it stay there at 2%. That's ridiculous. That has never happened before. You know, think back in the 1970s. Well, you know, I'm sure that the Fed didn't want interest rates going much higher than 2% or much higher than 5%, wherever they were back then at the beginning of the 1970s. But they eventually, the inflation interest rates went to 20%. So the idea that they can just like, you know, stick the landing on a certain interest rate is ridiculous. It's not verifiable economically or historically.
We talk about being in the everything bubble. I think most of my viewers and listeners totally understand that, but they always have the question, what do I do? And my framework for investing, I'm not a pro, for investing is very simple. I just say, okay, well, I just try to buy stuff that's cheap and sell it when it's expensive. But it's very long term. If you're someone who's trying to get maximum returns from, 3 month period to a 6 month period, you're not going to be able to do that. And I know that's what you specialize in. So as far as you've got this 20 point kind of model that you use for making more short-term trades. Can you give us a summary as to how that works?
So it's called the inflation, deflation, and economic cycle model. There's 10 components for the inflation, deflation dynamic, and there's 10 components for the growth and recession dynamic. So it just basically asks the question, are we as an economy, both the United States, the G3 countries is what I look at. So I look at United States, European bloc, and China. Those are the three main countries that I look at. And I ask myself, are these countries, are they growth and inflation accelerating or are they decelerating? It sounds, I guess it sounds both simple and complicated at the same time, but it's all based on calculus. So, that's the secret to the world, how the world works. So I just want to know, I don't want to know basically if we're going into a recession so much. I just want to know if we've reached peak growth and inflation rates here in the United States. That's currently what I'm asking myself. And the answer to that question is probably yes, depending, of course, upon fiscal and monetary policies. We have Joe Biden right now has proposed in the first, President Joe Biden has proposed in the first 100 days of his tenure, $6 trillion in spending, new spending. Now, from March of, I'm not trying to get political here, because from March of 2020 to March of 2021, then President Trump had $6 trillion passed in various forms of, stimulus, fiscal stimulus, which is never stimulus in the long run. In the long run, it's mostly stagflationary and actually hurts growth and engenders more inflation. And so the question is, can he pass another $6 trillion? I don't think he can. I think it's impossible because he doesn't have that kind of room in DC to do that. So I think that the rate of growth will slow in the second half of 2021. I think we're headed towards a monetary cliff in 2022. Don't forget, the Fed is now printing $120 billion a month. That's $1.44 trillion a year. Now, $1.44 trillion a year sounds like a lot. Let's say $1.5 trillion sounds like a lot to counterfeit in a year. But that's actually a reduction from what they did in 2020. The Fed expanded its balance sheet by about $3.5 trillion in 2020. As a matter of fact, they printed $7 trillion in confetti, in phony money, since 2008. So I look at these dynamics when I manage money. I have, like I said, a 20-point model. I look at various 10-2 spreads, break-even spreads, the level and direction of real interest rates, LIBOR spreads, LIBOR OIS, junk bond spreads. So it does get a little arcane. But it's kind of like measuring and analyzing the economy like a scientist would. And so I can determine what cycle we are in and what cycle we are headed in based on those model components.
Yeah, so you touched on a point there that I've been trying to think through in a lot of my videos, and that it seems like we've gone from having to answer economic questions to having to answer political questions. Because so much of the economy is now tied to government spending. And so I think a lot of my viewers assume that we're just going to get limitless stimmy checks and universal basic income. And Biden is just going to go from a $1.9 trillion package to a $3 trillion to a $5 trillion to a $10 trillion to a $20 trillion. It's never going to end. But you have a little bit different view. You think he's going to get some gridlock there, and that's not going to be a reality. Can you explain that a little further?
Well, he has, his hold over the House and the Senate just is very narrow. He's 50-50 in the Senate. That means he needs Senator Joe Manchin to go along with whatever he does. And Manchin is more of a moderate Democrat. And then he has five member lead in the House of Representatives. So he needs to get, you know, almost every Democrat aboard on board. But even a greater question is, you know, how much more debt can the bond market tolerate? You know, we do have some, you know, the construct of the economy in the United States is artificial. It's all artificially engendered. I mean, if we actually had a real economy, what do you think the cost of money would be if the Fed were to announce tomorrow? In fact, the Fed has a meeting today. This is being recorded on Wednesday. If the 2 o'clock press release said the Federal Reserve is now no longer expanding its balance sheet to zero and market rates will prevail, what do you think would happen? What do you think would happen to the stock market? What do you think would happen to the real estate market? So it would be an absolute depression like we've never seen before. So everything is artificial. And like I said before, we had $6 trillion in borrowing that was almost all monetized by the Federal Reserve in the last year. That's completely artificial. So when that ends, I assume that the bond market will at some point no longer tolerate deficits and debt. You know, what do you have? $28 trillion national debt right now. Total debt in the United States is 400%, 400% of GDP. That's an all-time record high. It's a little bit higher than it was at the nadir of the Great Recession in early 2009, late 2008, early 2009. So how much more debt can we withstand, especially in the context of the fact that the Fed will announce its tapering, in my opinion, probably later this summer?
Why do you think they'll do that? That's definitely contrarian.
So I said they'll announce the tapering. They will say, I believe the next few non-farm payroll reports will be blockbuster reports. Over 1 million jobs in the leisure and hospitality sector. Now, the good news there, of course, people getting back to work, but those are very low wage jobs. So that's going to, that will bring down the unemployment rate, but the employment cost index will also not get out of control, because they're traditionally low-wage jobs. You're not hiring, you know, people and lawyers and doctors and so much on Wall Street. You're hiring people who are food service workers, and they tend to be lower wages. So you'll bring down the employment cost index a little bit. Labor wages won't go out of control, but they will be higher, but not out of control. But when you say, you know, Mr. Powell says he wants to see significant progress towards rehiring all those people that got laid off during the pandemic. Well, a lot of that is going to be past us by the fall. And I think instead of actually raising interest rates, which is probably not going to happen, I don't think it happens. In fact, I'll go out on a limb and say, I don't think Mr. Powell will raise rates at all this cycle. I think he's going to stay at zero until we have our next recession. Okay. He said, you look at the FOMC dot plot, there really isn't a rate hike until 2024. I think we have a very big problem in this country, a deflationary problem in this country before then. So he's going to stay at zero. But he will announce the taper because there will be substantial progress towards meeting his goals of rehiring and bringing down the unemployment rate. The taper will probably start next year, 2022, and end by the end of the year.
When you say taper, you mean he'll reduce the $120 billion that he's buying right now, or he'll start selling?
No, the Fed will never sell a bond in its life. The Fed will reduce the expansion, the rate of increase in its expansion. So it'll do $10 billion a month. So it'll take a year to get down to zero. And then he'll just either keep the balance sheet and have a period of stasis for a while, or he will let it run off. In other words, when a bond matures, he won't go and buy another one in the open market. So that's how he will unwind his balance sheet. So the idea of the Fed actually selling bonds, and you know, when you're running an annual deficit of trillions and trillions of dollars, which is over 15% of GDP, the idea of the Fed adding to that by selling bonds, which is more debt that the free market economy has to absorb is out of the question. They'll never do it. They will let those assets roll off the balance sheet. That's what I'm predicting.
So if that happens, what do you think the long end of the yield curve does? Do you think it immediately spikes and therefore the stock market crashes?
So I look at it this way. I think short-term rates will rise on the announcement, and we'll have another taper tantrum where rates rise across the yield curve temporarily, very temporarily. And then I think then we enter into a period of disinflation, which would bring down long-term rates lower, bring them lower. So it would be just a temporary spike as they say, oh my gosh, the free market now has to take control of the bond market, and that's going to be disastrous in the short term. But then we realize, hey, wait a second, what does the real estate market and stock market do when interest rates spike? Well, they'll collapse, which will bring rates down.
Okay, so if our economy is built on asset bubbles, and I think the main asset bubble being the stock market, if that goes down by 20, 30, 40, 50%, that's going to crush the purchasing power of the average baby boomer, where the majority of the wealth is concentrated, and therefore nominal GDP's got to take a hit. So how far down do you think the Fed or the central planners can allow the stock market to go before they step in, reverse course, and takes just more extreme measures?
Yeah. So I thought about that a lot. And I think that number, the number comes to my head about 30%. I think if the stock market went down 10 to 15%, maybe even perhaps 20%, the Fed might enjoy that because, you know, Mr. Powell is feckless, but he's not an idiot. Okay. He's not completely inane. He understands that we're in a bubble in the stock market. He can't admit to that on a press conference, but he understands that prices in real estate and in equities have to come down. It would be healthy for the economy. So I don't think he would panic for a move that was 15 to 20%. But if the move lower on the S&P 500 goes to 30%, that would be enough to freeze up all of the credit markets. So all of the short term in money markets would freeze, repo markets would freeze, junk bond market issuance would freeze. And that would be enough to get him off the sidelines. The question I have is, if this occurs in 2022, which is my prediction that it will occur in 2022, probably in the teeth of the taper, sometime in that time frame, especially if we don't get $6 trillion of new stimulus coming from the government that has to be monetized by the central bank, then you're going to get this period of deflation. So disinflation will morph into deflation. And then the question is, and here's the salient question. If Powell says we're going back into QE and we're buying junk bonds in a big way, does the long end of the bond market respond positively? In other words, do prices go higher and yields come down, as they always have done since 1987? You know, every time the Fed has gotten involved in markets, it's because of a deflationary crisis where asset prices fall, right? Correct? So they are trying to reflate asset bubbles and reliquify credit markets. If that has been what's been inculcated to investors' minds, Fed comes in, they have the massive QE program, lower interest rates, and the recession begins to be turned around. It's ameliorated, mollified, and then we start heading higher.
Right.
But if Powell does it in 2022, he will have zero room to lower interest rates. Let's just start there. It normally takes 500 basis points or more of interest rate reductions to re-stimulate the economy and to reinflate asset prices. He'll have no room at that point. And he will also be in some form of QE. It may not be $120 billion a month. It may be $60 billion a month at that time. So, you know, at the height of the Great Recession in 2008, QE was $85 billion a month. It's now $120 billion. If he's already at some, you know, capacity of, say, $60 billion a month, going from $60 billion to $100 billion a month, is that enough to reinflate asset prices when he has no room to lower interest rates? And even if it's that successful, does the bond market remain quiescent. In other words, you know, think about this, George. In 2008, we were all told by Ben Bernanke that this was a one-time emergency measure that the Fed would have to undertake. We would expand the balance sheet, we would lower interest rates. Once the housing market healed, we would never have to do this again. This was a once in a 100-year storm. Well, that wasn't really true, right? I mean, you remember, you talked about it in the pre-interview, the repo market completely froze in the summer of 2019. The Fed was already in QE, back into QE in 2019, and had lowered interest rates three times by the end of that year. This was before the pandemic broke out. So the economy doesn't function. It can no, the asset bubbles and the artificial nature of these asset bubbles and the economy cannot exist unless interest rates are extremely low, practically zero. And you have a constant infusion of new monetary fuel. So now that Wall Street knows, hey, listen, you know, I believed you could get away, Federal Reserve, I believe you can get away with all this monetary inflation and deficit spending because deflation was our primary problem. What if they do it the next time and the Fed comes back in a huge way with QE, even bigger than before, adopts some form of universal basic income, and the bond market says, wait a second, I understand what's going on here. You will never be able to stop QE. You will never be able to raise interest rates. And that starts to affect the sovereign bond market here in the United States, which sends yields much higher. That's a risk. That's not a prediction. That's a salient risk. And if that happens, you will not stem the tide of a 30% reduction in equity prices. You'll have bond prices crater at the same time stock prices crater, at the same time real estate craters, because rates are rising instead of falling. Long-term rates are rising instead of falling as they usually have done. So you could turn a pretty bad recession and a pretty severe market correction into an absolute wipeout, 50 to 80%. That's the risk.
So most people would say, all right, Michael, I get that. But in that case or in that situation, would the Fed come in and try, being the operative word, institute yield curve control to prevent those rates to long end from going up and just doing and creating this economic devastation?
Well, they could try to cap long-term rates, but first of all, I don't think they have that kind of firepower. You know, you'll have whatever's left of the free market on Wall Street will just be dumping all the bonds they have, will no longer buy bonds and will short the bond market. So if you could tell me that the Fed is going to print, $100 trillion a day to buy bonds to mask the inflation crisis that they've engendered, my question would be to you would be, do they also assent to buying corporate debt,
right,
junk bonds, municipal bonds? Well, then, you know, you could cap, I guess you can, I doubt it, but it's potentially possible that you can cap long-term rates in the environment of intractable inflation. By the way, that's never worked in the past. Maybe it'll work this time because we have the world's reserve currency, which we are daily trying to abuse that, you know, privilege. But let's just say they're successful in capping yields. You have to cap every other fixed income, mortgage-backed securities, REITs, everything else that has a variable rate tied to it. The Fed has to assent to buying that too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about Weimar Germany or the Hungarian pengo, you know, but that's what the dollar would look like. So I don't take any solace when the Fed says, "Hey, we have a cycle of intractable inflation, and we're going to mask that by printing unlimited amounts of money." That only works when the market is convinced that our problem is deflation, not inflation already.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So I know we're a little limited on time, and I could discuss those topics, Michael, for probably the next 3 or 4 days and really enjoy it. But before we go, I want to get your opinion on just the basics, commodities, gold, Bitcoin, stocks, bonds, U.S.-centric, in the shorter term, in the next 3 or 6 months, because here we always talk about just long-term cycles, and I really don't get into the weeds. And since you're a specialist in that time frame, I'd love to get your opinion on those financial topics that pertain to so many people's portfolios.
Okay, so let's just start with equities. So after being, massively long equities in 2020 and the first quarter of 2021, I believe that we are now approaching the peak rate of change in growth and inflation. That's my belief. And so since the market is priced to absolute perfection, I did not short the market yet, but I did sell some of those exposures, for instance, to metals and mining based metals. I sold my exposure to banks, which love when the yield curve, the 10-2 spread widens. Maybe prematurely, maybe a few weeks early. But when the stock market is this overvalued, and when growth and inflation, in my opinion, should be peaking, it's just incredibly dangerous to be overexposed, like, Archegos. I run an RIA, and I run it like a hedge fund. It's not a hedge fund rubric. It's an RIA. But, I don't think Archegos, and by the way, there's more ways of pronouncing that hedge fund that blew up
I still don't know how to pronounce it.
There's the Wuhan virus, there's the coronavirus. There's so many names for that. But there's, more names for this hedge fund that blew up 5 times leverage. Now, I don't think this was idiosyncratic, particular to Archegos or Archegos. I think it's systemic. I think it's intrinsic in the financial system that there's so many shadow banks that have borrowed money from bank holding companies. And you think about the $10 billion in losses from this one hedge fund that blew up in the greenest of pastures, when the wood is completely green. What's going to happen when the Fed is in the middle of its taper and we have this fiscal and monetary cliff and COVID-19 resurgence comes back in the fall, which I think is very probable. And we start coming up with more lockdowns across the world. What happens when that is the case? How many Archegoses are there out there? And what does that do to the banking system? So that's one of the things that, I worry about. I don't really worry about it. I watch it because we're an active management strategy. I can, very easily, like I did in February of 2020, just go net short in the portfolio. Cash, buy the dollar, go, long duration, and short the market. Those are the four horsemen that I'll ride if that indeed happens in 22. The next topic is gold. I sold my as a gold bug. It's hard. It's painful to say this and admit this. But hey, listen, I was on record saying it. I get interviewed every week. I warned people in August and September of 2020 that we're entering something called a vaccine dead zone for gold, where the rates of change and growth and inflation we're going to be seen to be accelerating very rapidly. When that happens, you get nominal rates rising faster than inflation. That means you're having real interest rates rise, which is the bane of gold. This is exactly what's happening. We're still in the middle of it. I think we're at the tail end of it. I didn't say middle of it. We're still in the throes of that, but we're close to the end of it. I think that could be a gold, precious metal sector. It could be something that I invest back into late summer. That's my prediction right now. Bitcoin, I think, okay, here comes the hate mail. I think it's I want no part of Bitcoin precisely because I have no way of understanding its value. So where I've been dead wrong, hey, I've been wrong. Here's a guy that will admit he's been wrong. I've been completely wrong about the price action of all cryptocurrencies. But in my mind, they're impossible to value. They're not gold 2.0 because they're not limited in nature. There's 1,000 blockchains and 1,000 cryptocurrencies out there that all perform the same function. And there's an unlimited number of blockchains that you can create. You're trying to move a token, a private key, which is 64 letters and numbers. Nothing unique about a letter and a number that's electronic. It's nothing unique about it. It's like a glorified barcode. Moving around a blockchain anonymously and in a decentralized nature. There's an unlimited amount of that. So it's not gold 2.0. Bitcoin makes a horrible currency. It takes too much energy. There's just not enough bandwidth right now. And the biggest reason also is because it's $55,000 a unit. Well, this thing that gives Bitcoin its all value is the fact that it's decentralized. But you, the Bitcoin community, want Bitcoin to be accepted by Wall Street in order to underwrite its value. Well, if it's accepted by Wall Street, it could also be banned by governments, right? Because if you think about everybody who bought Coinbase, the IPO. I mean, Wall Street has to know who you are. They have anti-money laundering rules they have to abide by. They have know your customer rules. So your anonymity is gone. Your decentralized nature of your cryptocurrency is gone. And that means government can, at their whims, and I think, by the way, I didn't even touch on this, but I think, and I said this back in 2017, I was like one of the first people to say this, governments will adopt a completely digital currency.
Right.
Precisely because they need to move interest rates into the negative territory. And you can't do that when there's physical currency. I explained this all in 2017. So why would one way to get in trouble with a government is to have a competing currency. So why would a government compete with Bitcoin if they don't have to? They could say, listen, Bitcoin, it's illegal. You cannot conduct commerce, make any kind of transaction. All the exchanges are closed down. There's no more Coinbase. There's no more Wall Street participation in this field. That would knock the price down from 60,000 to maybe 1,000. And it would be relegated to the dark web, which is where it really should be. This is what you want. You want to be anonymous. You know, you want to have an immutable transaction. We'll go to the dark web and the government can't really touch you. But that takes it out of the mainstream. So,
yeah, but you made a good point in an interview I watched, Michael, where you said you think they're allowing people to use a crypto and get really emotionally engaged in crypto because they want people to be acclimated. And they sure. want to condition people to use that. So it's much more easier to roll out the central bank digital currency or Fed coin, if you will.
So that's exactly. So verbatim what I said in 2017, I've repeated it through the years, that the Fed will come out with something. I mean, call it Fed coin. The ECB will have an ECB coin, the PBOC coin. Actually, by the way, China is moving very fast towards having digital currency. And then, people will balk less at that because, hey, we've been using, we haven't been using cash for a while. It's perfectly mundane, perfunctory to use, digital currency. No more cash. India has banned large bills from circulation. So this is where we're moving. And I think it's, I don't know if it's completely nefarious and organized, but I believe maybe it is. Where they're saying, hey, listen, we're going to have to, in the next crash, the depression will be so great that we're going to need to have a permanent control and absolute control over inflation. And we can't do that with physical currency. Because if I go to just explain it, you know, if the bank where my money is in right now, where those banks told me, we're going to impose a negative yield on you of 10%, what would I do? I would go to the bank and remove my money, right? Everybody would do that. Who would accept nominal returns of negative 10%? That's before you adjust for inflation. Well, if currency is completely electronic, you only have two options. You can either spend your money, right, or leave it in the bank. You can't take it. You can't hoard cash. So that's where we're going. So I think this is an experiment of getting people used to a digital currency, and that's when they'll come and say, okay, all private cryptocurrencies are illegal, and we're going to use just our Fed coin. Trust us, you'll be happy with the results.
Yeah. Famous last words from the central planners and government. So how does the active manager view, or yourself, view commodities and bonds?
Okay, so gold is a currency. Bitcoin is more of a commodity. I think commodities are, you know, obviously they've been in a rapid bull market over the past year and a half. I participated in much of that rally. I've now sold that, as I mentioned before, because I think we're reaching the peak rate of change in growth and inflation. You know, later this year, you're going to have higher taxes. This is the second half of 21. Higher taxes. Interest rates will be much higher than they were when they hit the nadir of 0.33% on the 10-year note last summer. Okay. I mean, as crazy as that sounds. So interest rates are already higher. And inflation is going to be higher than it was last year. And then you're going to have the fiscal and monetary cliff. You know, it's amazing to me that people are so upbeat on the sustaining power of the U.S. economy. Well, you know, the consumer is healthy because you told them they're going to be sending them thousands and thousands of dollars in checks in the mail. Oh, and by the way, you don't have to pay your mortgage or student loan either. Well, of course the market's going to, of course the consumer is going to be healthy. Of course their savings rate is going to be higher. But I'm assuming that my assumption is the predicate here is that the second half of 21, the checks stop coming in, at least for a while, and you have to start paying your mortgage. Mm. You know, you're not going to be a lump sum payment for all the 18 months that you didn't pay, but there's going to be a more of a strain on your income statement here going forward. There's 2.7 million homeowners that are in some kind of distress here as far as paying their mortgage. 2.7 million homeowners. And that's going to occur at the same time with the Fed says we're going to start tapering our asset purchases. So on a second derivative basis, that's a reduction in stimulus. So and then, of course, the last thing I'll tell you is why I'm also sold the commodities, because I do believe that if you look at globally speaking, COVID-19 is ravaging parts of the world. So Brazil, India, global cases are at a record high, and global deaths are also close to an all-time record high and nearly twice what they were in April of 2020. Deaths, not just, Mr. Penta, it's because they're testing more. No, deaths of COVID-19, if you want to believe, you know, the statistics, are at very close to a record high globally and twice what they were in April of 2020, as I said. So this virus continues to rage in children and globally. I think the fall will come to the epiphany of understanding that, hey, COVID-19 will always be with us in some form, just like influenza. And you're going to have to get an annual booster shot, just like influenza. How many people are going to go through that? I actually got my Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I didn't die of a blood clot, which was nice. But I was very sick after that shot. I'm just being honest. I'm asking myself, do I want to voluntarily get another COVID vaccine shot? Is that better than actually getting exposed and immunity, natural immunity from COVID-19? So anyway, what I'm trying to say is that the, you know, ostensibly they're telling us that this summer will be the end of the virus. That's not true. So you have higher taxes, higher interest rates, higher inflation, fiscal cliff, monetary cliff, and a resurgence of COVID-19 in the fall. I think that's enough to put this massively overvalued real estate, stock market, and bond market in jeopardy.
Right. Therefore, you're taking some of the commodities off the table, or you're selling some of the commodities, just going into cash short term. What's your usual time frame, Michael? Is it like a 3 month, 6 month time frame in your investments?
So I try to look at what's happening now and in the next 3 months. So what's the cycle? Okay. That's, I don't, you know, for me to predict, I love when people come on CNBC and tell you what their 5 year predictions are for this, that, or the other. You know, even, you know, oh, gold's going to $10,000 an ounce. Well, wonderful. But what, I want to wait 10 years for that. What am I going to do now? Oh, the bond market, you know, I wrote a book in 2012 about the collapse of the bond market. Okay. I'm not investing for the collapse of the bond market constantly. I'm just saying this is what's going to happen. Eventually, we're going to have a reconciliation or a mean reversion of bond yields. And that's going to be devastating for the economy, even worse than when I wrote the book, because now when I wrote the book, bond yields were, you know, 2%, 3%, not zero.
Right.
Fed funds rate.
So there's a hell of a lot more bonds now.
And a heck of a lot more. And the quality of that debt is at an all-time low. Covenants are light. Quality is absolutely at the worst. Triple C debt is at the lowest yield in history. We can go on and on talking about the fragile nature of the corporate and sovereign bond markets, not only here, but across the world. So, you know, my idea right now is 3 months. Now to 3 months, what's going to work best? And I'm not saying that we're going to collapse now. What I've done is just for a short cycle. Now between 3 months, we could get a correction in the overall averages, and that has nothing to do with what I see happening in 2022. When you see this confluence of those five things that I mentioned before. So that's when we are subject to the 50 to 80% potential wipeout in the stock market. Right now, I'm just talking about a normal pedestrian 2 to 5%, you know, correction in stocks.
So where does that leave us with bonds in the next 3-6 months?
The bond market. I think bond yields will be doing. I think the currency, the dollar, might see some strength. And you might see some buying in the long end of the bond market, maybe, but I'm not predicting anything tremendously shocking to happen in the bond market any longer. I did predict, this is why I sold gold in August and September of last year. I did predict that, you know, 0.3, 0.5% on the 10-year was way too low. And that rate would head towards 2% was my prediction. And it went all the way to 1.77 or something like that. percent on the benchmark treasury. So I, you know, that's what I was hedged against. So that, I thought that would be very bullish for growth, very bullish for inflation, being base metals, energy, but not so great for gold. Again, gold is not a commodity, gold is a currency. So I think gold could be the only commodity that I own in starting in the summer of this year.
All right. Well, in the sake of time, Michael, we'll leave it there. That was a really awesome conversation. And I thank you for your time. I know we were only supposed to go about a half hour, but we just had a lot to talk about there. So I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
So the website is pentoport.com. My email address is mpento@pentoport.com. And the office number here is 732-772-9500. If you go to the website, I have a free trial subscription to my podcast, which I give you some, you know, thoughts from 36,000 feet. It's $49.99 a year if you like your 5-week trial. And again, if you have around $100,000 to invest in the IDEX portfolio, I will personally, you know, take care of the money for you and invest it according to that strategy.
Okay, great. Michael, I appreciate it. I can't wait to do it again.
My pleasure, George. Thank you for having me on.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to join me in Miami this June 11th through the 13th for Rebel Capitalist Live, the investment conference. And this is not over Zoom. This is face-to-face. I'm bringing a lot of your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist Show to Miami under one roof to speak, to give you the knowledge you need to increase your personal freedom, to become a better investor and make larger returns over the next few years when we have this financial uncertainty that's being caused by the Fed and the government. And finally, it's going to give you an opportunity to really take your understanding of macroeconomics and the world around us to the next level. We've got some incredible speakers lined up that are going to completely blow you away. People like Mike Maloney, Jason Hartman, Ken McElroy, Lynette Zhang, Mark Moss, Brent Johnson, Jeff Snyder, just to name a few. The tickets for this event are really going to sell out fast, so make sure you go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now to get all the details and to reserve your spot. We need to come together as a group, as a community, especially after what we dealt with in 2020 and 2021, so we can learn how to build wealth and thrive in a world of out of control central banks and big governments. And we need to do this as a group, as a community of fellow rebel capitalists. So don't waste any time. Head over to rebelcapitalistlive.com and I will see you in Miami.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.